Concerts with unusual themes performed in unusual venues are not at all unusual for the St. Louis Chamber Chorus. That's the case in Sunday's concert scheduled at the Carpelis Manuscript Library Museum. The theme is Revolution and Revelation. I spoke earlier this morning with Philip Barnes, the artistic director of the chorus, and Melissa Dunphy, the St. Louis Chamber Chorus composer in residence and composer of a featured work in the concert titled What You Think I Fought For at Omaha Beach. I suggested to Philip the D-Day invasion at Omaha Beach does not immediately come to mind when I think of chamber chorus music.
I would agree with you.
Totally. What's going on?
Well, it's this remarkable composer who has an ear for lyrics where the rest of us just see prose, I suppose. And Melissa has this extraordinary gift for hearing the innate musicality of some words, not necessarily words that rhyme or in meter. And the story of how she came across this testimony is very moving. It's something that she heard on a YouTube video. Somebody had posted this testimony that was given by an 86-year-old veteran of the Second World War for speaking in favor of the Marriage Equality Act before the State of Maine Senate, I believe. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Philip Spooner, the Reverend Philip Spooner, I think spoke very eloquently. He was a bit hesitant the way he actually enunciated his words, but the tenor of what he was getting at was extraordinarily powerful. And Melissa was wise enough to hear the musical possibilities in that.
Melissa, let me ask you to pick it up from there. What were you hearing and what were you feeling at this time?
Watching Philip Spooner give his speech, I think, is an incredibly moving experience. I encourage everybody to find it on YouTube. If you just Google, what do you think I fought for at Omaha Beach, it'll come up. And, you know, Mr. Spooner is not a polished speaker. He's an 86-year-old gentleman. His voice cracks with emotion when he speaks. And for my own personal reaction, I'll tell you, I burst into tears watching this speech. You know, he talks about how he was a VFW chaplain, and he talks about his war service, and you can hear and see the trauma that was writ on him by his service in World War II. And then he talks about how he fought for freedom and equality, and that these were the things that, you know, he fought for at Omaha Beach, the reasons for the sacrifices that he made and his fellow soldiers made. And he talks about how he has four sons and he wouldn't want his one gay son to be left out of any of that. It's beautiful and it's so heartfelt and it transcends politics or your political leanings. It's really about humanity and human rights and the emotions that you feel, you know, listening to his story.
Maybe I'm wrong about this, but it would seem to me that people of that generation might not feel so strongly about this particular issue.
Yeah, I think that was part of the reason that it hit me emotionally as well, because, you know, at the time, so this was in 2009, I believe, 2009 or 2010. Mm-hmm. There was a point in the debate where, you know, was this going to be a generational argument, you know, the older Americans versus younger Americans? And watching this particular speech really gave me and a lot of other people hope that this isn't about, you know, divisions within society, that a man who would not necessarily be the typical marriage equality supporter would understand this issue from the same perspective as people who were pushing for marriage equality.
How do you transmit this message musically?
For me, a lot of my music comes from just a place of emotion. You know, what emotions do I feel? That's the starting off point. Can I transmit my emotions musically? But also a lot of it comes from the text. I mean, I feel like when people get emotional listening to my piece, I don't think I know what part of it is my music and what part of it are Philip Spooner's words. And in some ways, especially when getting a text that is prose, not poetry. So there isn't a meter, there isn't a rhyming scheme. I have to find the music in those words myself. It's a little bit like getting a hunk of marble and chiseling away until you find the statue within it. I identify with those words. I think it was Michelangelo who said that, in that I have this hunk of text and I have to find how it makes sense musically.
You've actually altered the sequence slightly, haven't you?
I do to
make it more dramatic.
Right. I will take out parts of the text that don't work at all musically and find sort of the essence of what he was trying to say. I will overlap parts of the text that, for instance, in my piece where he's talking about his war experiences, I have different sections of the choir talking about, the places where he saw action, how he's seen him. He says in his speech, I have seen so much blood and guts, so much sacrifice, and sort of overlay those sections of text over each other. So you sort of get it in this wall of memory, which is sort of how I feel he was feeling when he was talking about his experiences in World War II.
Philip, this is at the centerpiece of your program, I gather, that's taking place this weekend. How did you come to choose it? And tell us more about the program itself, which really meanders, if you will, through history.
Yes, it's a program called Revolution and Revelation. So often you associate with choirs, with religious music, and indeed there is so much wonderful sacred music out there that our choir performs a great deal of it during the year. But there are also pieces that were written for not religious but political creeds. Yeah. And so I thought it'd be fascinating to put together a program on that idea. So we have some songs from the American Revolution. We have some songs from the failed German revolutions of 1848. That, of course, brought so many people, so many Germans to St. Louis, the 48ers, as they were called. And we, in the middle of all of this, I wanted to find something that was current, that was appropriate for now. And so this piece that Melissa wrote really sort of grabbed my attention. It's actually a slightly odd story behind it, and that is that this piece won a competition, big competition for choral music, the Simon Carrington competition, which is actually based in Kansas City, Missouri. And a friend of mine entered this competition, and I knew that she was going to win because it was a wonderful piece she'd written, and it was helped by the fact that I'd provided the libretto, so it was obviously going to win. And my pride, therefore, took a nasty knock when she didn't win. So I was obviously convinced that the winner was rubbish, and it was just going to be a put-up job. And I thought, well, but the least I can do is just listen to this rubbish. So I went on YouTube because they had posted the first performance in Kansas City. And I sat there, and as one of my colleagues said, about 30 seconds in, I issued an expletive, which I won't repeat here, which was basically, I think I now know why we didn't win. And it was this piece. And so it is an extraordinarily powerful piece. I've never told Melissa this, but I mean, I think it's way up there in the traditions of Copland and Roy Harris. It's got a sort of, interesting for somebody who, like me, isn't born an American but is now an American citizen, is that it's got a sort of quintessential American character to it, particularly when the choir sings, "What do you think I fought for at Omaha Beach? For freedom." When you hear that, you could just imagine Aaron Copland doing that. But it's not kitsch. It's not sort of pastiche Copland. It's in that tradition. So I thought this is a wonderful piece. And so eventually we came to record it, and we came to ask Melissa to be our composer in residence, which was quite a big step. So she's now writing music specifically for us. And we gave the first recording on CD of it, which is what we can hear on today's program.
We are going to listen to it in just a moment. But Melissa, I have to ask you, do his kind words make up for calling your work rubbish and using all the expletives that he apparently did?
More than. I love Copland. I mean,
I do too.
I adore Copland and Samuel Barber as well. Sometimes as an immigrant to America, and I've been in America for almost 14 years now, so it's been a little while. I'm a citizen. I'm a dual citizen of America and Australia. And, you know, there's a thing that people say about immigrants sometimes is that they become more American than Americans. And I think it's interesting in my work particularly because it is true that I've written about American subjects. I've written choral pieces that that are specifically about American subjects. And I think that Americanness does creep into my work. And I admire that tradition of American composers. So it's very nice. I feel quite flattered to be included in that tradition. Thank you.
I'm glad it's working out this way, folks. We want to listen to your piece, Melissa. Can you set up for us? We'll have a chance to listen to some of it, not all of it, of course.
We are coming in right before the section where the choir starts to sing, What Do You Think I Fought For at Omaha Beach? So Mr. Spooner, in his speech, talks about voting. At the voting booth, one of those survey takers came up to him and asked him, do you believe in equality for gay and lesbian people? And he says he was very surprised by her question and he didn't know what to say at first. And then he gives his response. This is sort of the climax of the piece and the climax of his speech.
Beautiful and certainly not rubbish. It is absolutely stunning. Yeah.
Thank you.
Delightful. Can't wait to hear the whole thing. Philip, coming back to you, you said something a few moments ago about timing. And the timing of this particular concert, Revolution and Revelation. No accident or...
I'm utterly brilliant. I saw this coming 2 years ago when I put this concert together. I mean, honestly, it's extraordinary, isn't it, how life has a habit of echoing art as opposed to the other way around. We plan our programs really 18 months to 24 months in advance. I wanted to do a concert at this rather extraordinary building that's opened up in St. Louis, the Carpalese Manuscript Museum. And I wanted to perform music that wouldn't be our normal fare, if you like. As I said earlier on, we do a lot of religious music, but there's a lot of wonderful music out there by, you know, names like Schumann and Kodály and Benjamin Britten that is not religious. And so I thought we'd put this whole program together and have the theme of revolution, revelation. The museum has brought in a lot of original manuscripts about Eva Peron, a real revolutionary in her own right, Evita, of course. And so the audience will get to see that exhibit in the intermission between the two halves of our program. So to me, two years ago, it seemed just rather like a wonderful foil to a season that had a lot of religious music in it. Now, of course, I realize that I am utterly gifted and inspired by some sort of oracle.
What do you hope the audience will take away in the result, as it, on the basis of what you've just said? What do you hope people will leave the concert with?
Well, the same thing, really, that I hope for all our concerts, and that is that choral music is a very elemental form of art. No instruments, no distractions, just the human voice, and we all have a human voice, and words. And it's the only form of music, of course, that is that blend of words and notes. So you're actually forced to think about the words in a different way than if you were just reading them to yourself. And this concert shows you, really, that the power of the human voice is to be found in the service of so many causes, not just religious. And some of those causes you will agree with, and some of them you won't. And that's fine. I don't myself necessarily believe in some of the religious tenets of pieces that we sing, but they're beautiful works of art, so we go ahead and do it. So maybe you are not particularly comfortable with the agitprop of Hans Eisler from 1928, but you'll be pretty stirred by the music. I'm not sure many people would be against Benjamin Britten's aims of advanced democracy, written in 1938 against the storm clouds of Europe. But when do we get an opportunity to hear this type of music? I think this is what the chamber chorus exists for, is to give you exposure, and to give our singers, by the way, exposure to types of music that they wouldn't ordinarily anticipate.
Yeah. Melissa, same question to you. What do you hope the takeaway is from your piece?
I believe that music comes from has almost a unique ability among the arts. I mean, all art does this, but music in particular has a unique ability to tap into our emotions and to really foster emotional understanding of a point of view or of an experience. And there's something about choral music in particular which can really reach you, even if it's an experience outside of your own or a point of view completely outside of your own. When, you know, if you don't belong to a particular religion, sometimes if you go into their church and you see the beautiful church and you listen to their church choir, even if you don't agree with that religion or you're not part of that particular religion, you can understand why people are. So in that way, choral music has a unique ability to really heal a polarized society, or at least to reach across that aisle so that we can all understand the humanity, the shared experience, the shared emotions behind certain points of view. And, you know, my piece has been performed in Christian universities to people who absolutely don't agree with the Marriage Equality Act. And I've been told by people who've sung it that it is something that is able to reach people and get them to think and feel.
But of course, the time has changed, too, since it was written.
Yeah.
It has changed rather dramatically and rather quickly for such an issue.
It has. I strangely enough, look forward to a day when my piece is not immediately and urgently relevant. Yeah. I look forward to a day when it becomes like the agitprop of, you know, 1928 Germany. I don't think we're quite there yet. I think that it's still, you know, as much as we have a National Marriage Equality Act, there is still a sense of urgency in the message behind this piece right now, and what it means to Americans that are LGBTQ. I think that still, I wish it weren't so relevant, but I think that it is.
Well, at this particular time politically, too, it is an issue that is resurfacing in a different way. I mean, the momentum maybe slowed a little bit.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I actually heard this piece. I had an opportunity to hear this piece sung by another wonderful choir, Cantus, an all-male choir in New York City the day after the most recent election. And the entire audience was, I mean, myself included, and even members of the choir were so emotional listening to this piece, and which was not something that I immediately expected. You know, I wrote this piece almost 7 years ago now, and you know, something that comes with writing pieces about current events is you always think, well, one day it's probably going to become a relic. You know, it might not be quite as relevant, but it's almost like in some ways people need to hear this message that somebody who they would not expect to have this point of view can have this point of view. They need that message more than ever now.
They'll have an opportunity to hear that message and others February 12th, what's Saturday night, I guess?
Sunday afternoon.
Sunday, beg your pardon. They'll have an opportunity to hear it on Sunday afternoon, and I'm sure you're going to have a full house. How many can you accommodate at Carpellis?
I think about 400. Yeah. And quite a lot of the tickets have already gone, but I'm pretty sure there will still be some tickets at the door. And it's a wonderful place for a concert. There are none of those irritating pillars to be seated behind, and the seating is raked, so it's rather good place for a choral concert because excellent sight lines and fairly comfortable seats.
You have a knack for picking unusual places to perform, and this is certainly one of them. But a wrestling arena at one point, or something to do with wrestling, I think I read somewhere.
Yes, we did a concert called Musicians Wrestle Everywhere, and it had to, which is Emily Dickinson, by the way, before somebody complains, but that was at the South Broadway Athletic Club in their wrestling arena. And I hope to go back there. It was a fantastic place. Wonderful people who are accommodating us there. People are very, very welcoming and inviting all over St. Louis. And as a transplant to this city, I'm always in awe and appreciation of the incredible variety of buildings that this city has to offer. We are by no means done with exploring them.
We look forward to the concert at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. And Melissa, congratulations to you on that rubbish that you got.
Thank you. I am delighted to bring my rubbish to the world.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Philip Barnes, the artistic director with the St. Louis Chamber Chorus, and Melissa Dunphy, the composer in residence with the chorus. The next concert by the chorus is Sunday, February 12th, Revolution and Revelation, at the Carpellis Manuscript Library Museum at 3 o'clock. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Doerr, Colin Mueller, Monica Ramirez, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Arts and culture programming on St. Louis On the Air is funded in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.